lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you had taken from somebody.
You're listening to episode 505 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton. This week's show, Deconstructing the Matrix, is an attempt to understand how people do what they do and why, but on a deeper level than we usually address this question. It starts with a remarkable presentation by the cognitive linguist George Lakoff. He presents his view of metaphor not as a linguistic device, but as a deep structure in the brain itself. He contrasts two alternative parental metaphors, the strict father and the nurturing parent, and examines their different implications for politics and economics. And this is going to set the scene for some more deconstructions later in the show, including one of my absolute favourites, a reading from Lynn from episode number 87, reading Richard K. Moore's essay Escaping the Matrix, that deconstructs the spin that was used as cover for the ongoing privatisation of the commons. And then we're going to look at some deconstruction by Michael Hudson, who is cutting straight to the point of what all these bailouts are really about. So let's start now with a presentation called Moral Politics from George Lakoff.
One of the things you learn in cognitive science right away is something very obvious. You can't think without a brain. That may sound obvious, but when you get into the details, it's actually quite profound. The shape of the brain structures how you understand the world, and any idea you have that you've learned that you use over and over again that is part of your conceptual system is physically represented in your brain. And that fact matters for politics enormously. One of the things we've learned is that, as Andy said, Descartes got it wrong. The idea that we are all just have the same rationality, that we all think in the same way, that we all have a universal conceptual system, is not true. There are certain universals of thought. I mean, we know a lot about those. But there are also lots of differences in what I'll call framing and in metaphorical thought. There are also universals of metaphorical thought. If you're not used to metaphorical thought, let me give you an example of it. Take the notion of morality. There are lots of metaphors for morality. For example, morality is uprightness. So someone who's upright or low down and so on. But there are others much more interesting that you think in terms of. Take the idea of morality as accounting. That's one of the major metaphors around the world for morality. For example, in that well-being, morality is about well-being, about harming and helping people. Well-being is seen as a kind of wealth. So if I do you a favor, you can say, I'm in your debt. I owe you one. How can I ever repay you? It's sort of as if by doing you a favor, I've given you money, wealth. If I harm you, however, it gets more interesting. How do the moral books get balanced? Well, I can make up for it. That's restitution. Or I can, you can pay me back in kind. That's retribution. Or you can take something good away from me. That's revenge. Those are the normal ways of doing it. There's a kind of moral arithmetic to this, in which giving bad is the equivalent of taking good. That is, harming someone back who's harmed you is the equivalent of taking something good away. And that's how metaphor works. But it works in your thought. It's not just in language. It's in the way you understand what morality itself is. And there are other forms of this. Forgiveness is like forgiving a debt. I remember vividly Sandy driving me up to college, and on the way he was telling me about how Nietzsche had observed that in German the same word for guilt is the word for debt. And there's a reason for that. It's the moral accounting metaphor. So this is an extremely important form of thought, and that's one of the things I've been studying for a lot of years. Another important form of thought has to do with what I'll call framing. Framing is the simplest, most obvious thing in everyday life. For example, suppose you have a cup. If you have a cup is a very small object, and you understand it every time you hear a word cup as a container that you can usually pick up with a hand that you typically put liquids in and you drink out of. Okay? Very simple. No problem. You have a frame, a conceptual mental structure for a cup. And if I say, there's a cup on the table, you'll think of a cup. Now, when I start to talk about framing, the first thing I do is give my students an exercise. And the exercise is very simple. It goes like this. Don't think of an elephant. Whatever you do, do not think of an elephant. Okay? And nobody can do it. Some people claim they can, but I don't believe them. And the reason for this is as follows. The word elephant evokes a frame, evokes a mental image and knowledge about that image. If you negate it, you preserve the frame. Negating it still evokes that frame. Now, when you take a political example of this, my favorite simple example is tax relief. On the first day that George W. Bush took office, press release came out of the White House about his tax relief plan. This was read on TV over and over. And I noticed it. I said, oh, gee, that's interesting. He's got this term tax relief. And then it was the same the next day and the next day and the next day after that. Now, a linguist looking at this says the following. Look at the word relief. What is its frame? What sort of mental structure do you have? For there to be relief, there must be an affliction, something that harms you. There has to be an afflicted party who's harmed by it. A reliever who takes away that affliction is a kind of hero. And if anybody tries to stop him, there's a bad guy because they're trying to stop someone from relieving this affliction. If you add tax to that, you get a metaphor. Taxation is an affliction. And every time you hear tax relief, that is what goes in your mind. And you hear it over and over and over until it becomes part of your physical brain, until it's in the synapses of your brain. And when that happens, it becomes common sense. Now, let's suppose you are then invited on to Fox News. Here's how Fox News works. Fair and balanced, we have two liberals and two conservatives and one conservative host. And the host gets to frame the question. Are you for or against the president's tax relief plan? Do you like tax relief or are you against tax relief? It doesn't matter which it is. Taxation is still an affliction. In short, if you take the other side's terms, if you're opposing something, some political position, and they define a term in terms of a frame that fits their ideology, if you argue against the term, it's just the same as arguing for it. You're evoking it, and you're reinforcing it in the minds of the public. Right? Now, it's a very simple idea, comes out of cognitive science, and it's profound. It's one of the reasons why you have a wonderful cognitive science department here that I hope you all appreciate and support, because this is the kind of result that is very important. There are others that are important. First of all, that frame is what I'll call a surface frame. It goes with words. It's kind of superficial. It depends on deeper framing. It depends on framing that has to do with the way you understand the world. And I started working on this. This is in the book Moral Politics. I guess it first started in 1992. In the summer of 92, I was watching the Republican National Convention. Largely, I'm a liberal. I watch it out of civic duty. I'm serious about this. It's an important thing to understand how public discourse works in this republic, and I care about that a great deal. I particularly wanted to hear Dan Quayle's acceptance speech because it was written by William Kristol, and I wanted to hear what Kristol had to say. As Quayle started his speech, I was sitting in my living room watching this, and I became extremely embarrassed because I could not understand Dan Quayle. I understood every word in every sentence. That was not the problem. It was how the sentences fit together. And everybody else there seemed to get it. They were clapping and waving their signs. And this was written by Kristol. I mean, it was not Dan Quayle alone that I didn't understand. So I sat there and I said, okay, I'm going to remember at least one of these things that are embarrassing me. And it was Quayle's argument against the progressive income tax. It was a one-sentence argument. And here's how it went. Why should the best people be punished? Everybody claps, waves their signs, and I'm sitting there saying, why is this an argument against the progressive income tax? I just don't get it. But those guys do, and I'm a professor of semantics. Right? This is embarrassing. The next embarrassment came in 1994. Again, out of civic duty, I went down to my wonderful local bookstore, picked up a copy of The Contract with America, and became instantly embarrassed. I could not understand the following problem. I had just published a book on categorization, on how people categorize, and I couldn't understand the category conservative. I'm a liberal. I mean, it was a problem, and here's why. I couldn't understand why it was that the same people who were against abortion were for the flat tax. I had no idea what abortion had to do with the flat tax. And I couldn't understand why the same people who were for the flat tax were against environmental regulations. And I couldn't understand why the people who were against environmental regulations were for owning guns. And I couldn't understand why those folks who were for owning guns were for tort reform. I couldn't figure out what any of these had to do with any others. So I said to myself, well, look, I have the opposite views on every one of these things. What unites them for me? And then I really got embarrassed. I had no clue. Now, this is a typical case of a cognitive science problem. Right? This is a problem for a cognitive linguist who studies semantics. That is, what is it that brings together these ideas and unites them in such a way that they fit together in some natural order? And what is it that makes this possible? And how is it that if you're a sort of hardcore liberal or conservative, you can hear a new position and know what you think about it? Right? That's a cognitive science problem. I had no idea how to do it, but I started doing research. That's my job. And as a linguist, I started, interviewing people, taking down notes on what happened. So, for example, I would go out and talk to liberals and interview them, easy in Berkeley, and they would say, oh, those conservatives are so irrational. How can you be pro-life and for the death penalty? And then I would find some conservatives, impossible in Berkeley, not impossible, and even elsewhere, and they would say, oh, you liberals are completely irrational. How could you not want to put a murderer to death and sanction abortion? Now, when you come across this as a cognitive scientist, you notice that you're dealing with a well-known phenomenon, different worldviews. Worldviews where the logic, the normal logic of P and not P is not at issue, where each of these makes sense within these different worldviews. So the question is, what is it that defines those worldviews? How do you characterize it? And what we do is we get lots and lots of data. So I would collect, expressions. I would listen to arguments on both sides, write down, the logic of these arguments, figure out how they worked, notice who used what metaphors for morality. They were quite different. And then I finally asked the following question. Why is it that conservatives talk so much about family values? And what are those family values? Why, in a presidential campaign with issues at stake like nuclear proliferation and global warming and war in the Mideast, do they talk about family values? What is going on? And so what I did was I said, I realized as I thought this through, that a student of mine had written a term paper showing that we all have a metaphor of the nation as a family. That is, look, we send our sons and daughters to war. We have founding fathers, daughters of the American Revolution. Right? And so I sat down, I worked out the metaphor for the family in detail, for the nation as family in detail. I said, look, if we have two different notions of the nation, maybe there are two different notions of the family here. So I worked backwards. I said, okay, here are the different political positions. What notions of the family would structure these positions? Straight cognitive science problem. And out popped two notions of the family, a strict father family and a nurturant parent family. And you can kind of guess which is which. Now, I then discovered that having lived in Berkeley, when I started talking to other people outside of Berkeley about this, they pointed out that there was a guy named James Dobson who talked about conservative notions of the family, in fact, was teaching people. Dobson, as I'm sure you know down here, is the country's most popular columnist, appearing in more newspapers than anyone else. He's on something like 3,000 radio stations. He has so many people writing for his books and his pamphlets that he needs his own zip code. He has about an operation of between $200 and $300 million a year. And he has gotten his mode of child rearing into starting with fundamentalist churches and then other churches, child care centers, and so on around the nation. He is the guy who's in charge of Focus on the Family. Now, what is it that Dobson teaches? Well, Dobson, of course, is an author. He's written various books. His classic is called Dare to Discipline. I found this in Berkeley. It wasn't easy, but it wasn't in the local bookstore, but it wasn't that hard. You have to go to your local Christian bookstore, and even in Berkeley, there's a local Christian bookstore. You go down past Cody's down on the right, and you find the Jews for Jesus bookstore. And you put on your dark glasses and your trench coat. But there on the shelf is the new Dare to Discipline and lots of other right-wing child care books. Now, what's interesting about this is that when you see what Dobson's teaching, it's exactly what I constructed out of doing the cognitive science. It's a model of the family that's ideal, but he teaches it as a real case. It's really out there. And it turns out to structure conservative ideology in general and a certain view of morality, which I'll call strict morality. It goes like this. Why do you need a strict father? There's a difference, by the way. It's a gendered system. Daddy is different from mommy. You've got to have both. It's got to be a gendered system. Why do you need a strict father? Because there's evil out there in the world, and he's got to protect the family from evil. Because there's competition out in the world. There will always be winners and losers. He's got to be a winner to support the family. Because children are born bad in the sense that they just want to do whatever feels good. They don't know right from wrong. And you need a strict father to teach them right from wrong. By the way, when Sonny Bono was elected to Congress, I, you know, stood up late at night to watch his acceptance speech, and he came out and he said, "We're going to Washington and teach our kids right from wrong." Honest. So you need a strict father to teach your kids right from wrong. How do you do it? Well, Dobson says there's only one way: punishment when they do wrong, and maybe reward when they do right. It's a sort of behaviorist system. And the punishment, he says, must be painful enough so that the child will want to discipline himself or herself to do the right thing to avoid the punishment. That's the idea, to get internal discipline to avoid the external discipline. And Dobson, by the way, is one of the more liberal people on this matter. He says that you should never hit a child under the age of 15 to 18 months. There are other authors who have it earlier, like from birth. Now, if a child is disciplined, that's the only way a child becomes a moral being, through such discipline. And if the discipline occurs, there's an extra bonus. What's the bonus? The bonus is they can then pursue their self-interest to become self-reliant and prosperous. That is, there's a link between morality and prosperity. The same discipline that allows you to be moral. Morality is seen as obedience to a moral authority, God or the strict father at home. That the same discipline that allows you to be obedient to a strict father is the discipline that allows you to become prosperous. And there's a logic here. Suppose you're not prosperous, then you're not disciplined enough. And if you're not disciplined enough, don't have the discipline to be moral. So you deserve your poverty. And that has social implications. Now, another major part of this model is that after a child has grown and become mature, if they have gotten the self-discipline, they can go out in the world and take care of themselves. If they haven't, if they're still dependent and haven't been sufficiently disciplined, then they also should go out in the world. They receive, by the way, the name for this discipline is called tough love. There's a word for it. They have to go out in the world and be disciplined by the world. And if they can't make it, too bad. Okay? But by the time they're adults, that's what they should be. Now, there's another part of this. Why is it moral within this system to pursue your self-interest? And Dobson is very clear about this. This is a version of Adam Smith's view of capitalism. The idea in at least the popularized version of Adam Smith is actually a more complicated thinker than that, is that if everybody pursues their own profit, then by the invisible hand, as a law of nature, the profit of all will be maximized. Right? So it's good to pursue your self-interest because you're helping everybody else. And what's bad? What's bad is to interfere with people who are pursuing their self-interest. Well, how do you interfere with that? Well, one, you could have a disincentive for pursuing their own self-interest, namely taxation. And that is why Dan Quayle said, why should the best people be punished? Because they are the good people who are pursuing their self-interest. The other form is government regulation that gets in the way of people pursuing their self-interest. And there's also a term in conservative language for people who don't pursue their self-interest, people who are out to help other people. Primarily. There's a name for that, and Tom DeLay recently referred to George Soros with this term. It's the term do-gooder. A do-gooder is somebody who's trying to help other people and therefore gets in the way of those good people who are pursuing their self-interest. Now, there are lots of other parts of this model of the family, and you can begin to see how, what does it say, for example, about social programs? It says all social programs are immoral because they hurt the people they're trying to help. Why? Because they give them something they haven't earned, and that makes them dependent, and it takes away their ability to be disciplined, which takes away their ability to be moral beings. So social programs are immoral. according to this logic. Right? Also, you have the idea of the strict father as a moral authority. Well, a moral authority is a very interesting idea because it brings together two ideas, morality and authority, morality and power. And part of conservative thought is that that is correct, that the people who are powerful are the people who are moral. The moral people should rule. And that means the disciplined people should rule. And that gives rise to a hierarchy. The hierarchy of what I'll call the moral order. In the moral order, which is part of conservative thought, you have God above man above nature, very important piece of that, adults above children, Western culture above non-Western culture, America above other nations. It's the idea that if you look at forms of authority historically, that will show you what God has made moral, as the morality should line up with it. And then you have other versions that some conservatives have, but not others, namely bigoted versions. You have things like men above women, whites above non-whites, straights above gays, Christians above non-Christians. Now, not everybody, not every conservative has those last four. There are non-bigoted conservatives, and we're going to go into lots of types. But it's important to understand, and it's something that was rather interesting for me as a liberal. I grew up as a liberal thinking that conservatives were either irrational or mean or greedy or stupid. And they're not. I mean, some are. But that's also true of some liberals. I mean, they're moral. They have that morality, strict morality. For the most part, most conservatives, there are some who are mean and greedy and who, you know, fine, we can name them. But for the most part, strict conservatives see themselves as moral people. And it's very hard for a liberal to swallow this, to say that there are people who have a different morality than they have. Now, what morality would a liberal or progressive have? Well, the nurture and parent family that structures progressive thought goes like this. In the nurture and parent family, you have two parents who are equal. They both have the same responsibility for raising their children. And in that family, their job as a nurturer is to raise their children, is to nurture their children. And a second part, to raise their children to be nurturers of others. A major, major piece not to forget, to raise their children to be nurturers of others. What is a nurturer? Two things. It requires empathy and responsibility. Empathy. You have to identify with your child. You have to know what all those screams are. And responsibility, you have to take care of yourself because you can't take care of someone else if you're not taking care of yourself. And you have a responsibility toward your child or children. Right? And that's awesome. You have to be strong to do this. I mean, you know, parenting is not for weaklings. And then you raise your children to do the same, to care about others and be responsible for themselves and others. It's the opposite of permissive parenting, the very opposite. Now, from this, many things follow. And what follows is progressive thought in politics as well as a view of a nurturing family. If you care for your children, if you empathize with them, you want to protect them. You know, what do you want to protect them from? Well, obviously, you know, crime and drugs, but also cars without seat belts, smoking, poisons in the environment, etc. All the things that liberals want the government to protect citizens from. If you care about your children, and notice, this is a major idea in progressive thought. We have environmental protection, worker protection, consumer protection, safety nets, central in progressive thought. If you care about your children, you want them to be treated fairly. And fairness and equality are central to progressive thought. If you care about your children, you want them to have happy and fulfilled lives. And happiness is an important part of this. You want to have a happy family. Why? Because if you're not happy and fulfilled in your life, you're not going to be empathetic towards someone else. You're not going to want somebody else to be happier than you are. So it's a moral obligation to have a happy, fulfilled life if you're going to care about other people. And the same is true with your children. You want your children to have happy, fulfilled lives. So that fulfillment in life becomes a very important part of progressive thought. And you can't be fulfilled if you're not free to pursue your dreams. And this is very clear. There's a reason why liberty and the pursuit of happiness go together. If you can't be free if there's no opportunity, and you can't have opportunity for everybody if there's no general prosperity. So opportunity and prosperity are part of progressive thought. And you live in a community. What kind of community do you want to live in? Well, you want to live in a community which is a nurturing community, where you have leaders who care about the people in the community and are responsible. And you want community members who care about each other and are responsible to other members of the community and to the community itself, people who do community service. What kind of community is that? It's one where there's cooperation. For cooperation, you need trust. For trust, you need honesty and openness. Those are progressive values, and that's it. Those are the progressive values. Every single piece of progressive legislation has always been in the service of one or more of those values. Now, what's interesting to me as I started going through this in moral politics and seeing how these two notions of the family structured two ideologies, several things became clear. First, we all grow up with both of these models. Hey, you can be nurturant in every part of your life, politically, in your family, with your friends, in your community, but you can walk into an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie and understand it. And if you understand it, you've got a strict father model, at least passively. And the same is true for a conservative who happens to flip the TV and Oprah comes on and they can understand it. They may not live it or like it, but they can understand it. And it's very important to understand that we all have these views, and that even the most strong progressive and conservatives among us have the opposite within us. It's, you know, a sort of daunting thing to notice. But what's really interesting is that there are the people who are so-called in the middle. Those folks who are not the strong conservatives and progressives, turns out they have a mixture of these two models. They are conservative, they have strict morality in some parts of their lives, and nurturant morality in others. And this is something that Ronald Reagan understood. What were the Reagan Democrats? The Reagan Democrats were blue-collar workers who were strict fathers at home and nurturant in their union politics. And so Reagan used metaphors for the home in talking about politics to move people with their morality from the home to use that morality for politics. Very important. He did it all the time. And it was conscious. I had the pleasure, I will say, of talking to Richard Wirthlin a couple of weeks ago. He was Reagan's chief strategist. I met him at a conference. And he was very generous and very open with me about this. And he said some very interesting things. He said, first, I asked him about working with Reagan. He said, well, when I first started working with Reagan, I had gotten my degree in economics from Berkeley, and I believed in the rational actor model, and I was a pollster, and I found that there was a mystery to Reagan. I was told that people voted for people on the basis of their programs, on the issues. And when I surveyed people on the issues, they were all against Reagan's positions on the issues, but they liked Reagan. It didn't fit anything I was taught. And then he said, well, what's really involved here was that people identified with Reagan. They trusted him. They sensed his values, and they identified with those values, not with the positions on the issues. And that's true. It's true with Reagan, it's true with George W. Bush. It's something that the Republicans learned and that the Democrats have not learned. And that's a sad fact. But it's what's important about this is that he understood that Reagan had to address people in the middle and get them to trust him on the basis of his values. And so he gave his strict father values out there using metaphors from the family to move people who were in the middle toward his conservative position very consciously. And that's still being done in Republican politics today. It's something that the Democrats haven't learned. Now, why have the Democrats not learned this? They haven't learned it for actually a very interesting reason, having to do with the history of progressive thought. The way progressive thought is usually thought about by theoreticians who write about this, and actually in the actual history of who read who, is that progressive thought came out of the Enlightenment. What Enlightenment views? Rationalism. Rationalism said, we are all rational beings. Everybody is equally rational, and therefore, we can govern ourselves. We don't have to depend on the king or the church to tell us what to do. We can govern ourselves. And not only that, we're all equal in terms of our rationality. So we should have a democratic government. In addition, it's irrational to be against your material interests. Therefore, a rational government should be in favor of the material interests of all people. That's tradition of progressive thought. In addition, facts matter. Science matters because facts have consequences for material interests. Therefore, if you just present people the facts, they will reason to the right conclusion. False. There's a flaw there. The flaw is just that. At the time, they didn't know about framing and metaphorical thought. The idea of rationalism was that all thought was literal, that people only thought literally about things, that there was no framing, there was no metaphorical thought. And in addition, not only did people just think literally about things, they were conscious of their thought according to that view. And we know from cognitive science that most thought is unconscious. Most people don't know all the frames they use. They don't, not aware of the metaphors they use. They just do it. And it's a remarkable thing to know that now. But this history of rationalism had a profound effect, and it's still there in the Democratic Party. In the Democratic Party, you find people who will defend this rationalist position, and it has a consequence in polling. Democrats and Republicans use polls in the opposite way. Democrats assume that since people are rational and vote in favor of their self-interest, what you have to do, and that they're aware of their self-interest and aware of their reasoning, the assumption is they will take polls, ask their positions, and say, what are you in favor of? What's the most important thing to do to you? The Democrats will get a list, and then they'll make up programs to address those interests, and they'll run on the programs, and they'll lose. Over and over. Now, sometimes they won't lose, sometimes they'll win, because it may turn out that people's identity, people vote their identity with someone, may coincide with their self-interest. When that happens, they'll win. But otherwise, they often lose. Now, Republicans use polls in a different way. They use polls either to advance their agenda. For example, you have a polling question, are you for or against tax relief? You know, overwhelmingly for, right? There are lots of polling questions like that to advance an agenda or to find out where people are so you can change them. Republicans know how they want to change them and how they want to move people. So it's a very different use of polls, one based on rationalism and one based on a deeper understanding of how the mind actually works. And it's sad to me that conservative Republicans have done better at this. But it's not an accident that they've done better at this. When Goldwater lost in 1964, nobody wanted to be a conservative. Conservative was a dirty word. Everybody wanted to be a liberal. Goldwater lost, he was, you know, wiped out. And the conservatives went back to the drawing board and started, you know, working out why they lost and what to do about it. The fateful year in that history was 1971. In 1971, at the height of the Vietnam War, the National Chamber of Commerce asked Lewis Powell, who was about to be nominated to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon, to write a memo about what they saw as a problem. And the problem was this, that the best and brightest of American students were not becoming conservative businessmen. In the Vietnam War, they rebelled against conservative business practices, and this was seen as a disaster by Lewis Powell and the Chamber of Commerce. So Powell devised a plan. He said, here's what you've got to do. First, you have to get wealthy conservative businessmen to pool their resources, put them together, and do a list of things. First, endow chairs teaching conservative business principles in American universities, like the Olin professorships, to support or create institutions in those universities to teach those principles, you know, like the Hoover Institution at Stanford, which is supported in that way. There's an Olin Institute at Harvard. But you can't trust the universities, he said. So you need to set up your own research institutions. You need to get think tanks and get the best scholars you can to teach these general principles, these conservative principles, and to do research supporting them. Get the best research you can, researchers, the best research assistants, pay them well, get them good facilities, and not only that, they have to become respectable. How do they become respectable? You have to create journals where they can publish, like the City Journal in New York, out of the Manhattan Institute. You have to create magazines that they can publish in, like the Weekly Standard. You have to get book publishers to publish their books, like Regner A. Press. And you have to buy up media, hence Clear Channel, Murdoch, etc. What you have since then is the development of more than one think tank per year in those years, since 1971. There are now between 40 and 80 of them. About 40 of them are major think tanks, you know, supported $5 million or so or more. The best endowed have budgets between $30 and $40 million a year. And they spend about $400 million a year, almost half a billion dollars a year on conservative think tanks. In short, they have an intellectual operation that is doing its job. And what is the job it's doing? A very important job for conservatives. It used to be the case that types of conservatives used to hate each other. And they brought them together over a period of time, beginning in the 1950s and moving up recently. And you can begin to see some of the fractures now in the Harriet Myers nomination debate. But the fractures have been there for a long time, and they've sort of figured out how they fit together. There are many types of conservatives. There are fundamentalist conservatives, religious conservatives. There are libertarians. They don't necessarily get along. But recently, you begin to see libertarians who are fundamentalists, who come together in terms of what has been called the fusion movement. You have fiscal conservatives, like the old Rockefeller conservatives, who are not strictly libertarians, and never got along with the social or religious conservatives. And you have social conservatives. Now you have neoconservatives, and what I'll call thoroughgoing conservatives. In each case, they have a strict father morality that structures at least some part of their lives, either their religion. For example, fundamentalists have a view of God as a strict father. We give you commandments, you follow them, you go to heaven. If not, you go to hell. But I'll give you a second chance. My son will let you off. But now you follow them, you go to heaven. If not, you go to hell. There are more progressive Christians in the country than conservative Christians, but they, if you interview them, they're not very good on their theology and its relationship to politics. But their theology is very clear. God is a nurturing parent. God offers you grace, and grace is metaphorical nurturance. You have to be close to God to get grace. You cannot earn grace. It is given unconditionally. It heals you. It makes you strong. It makes you a moral being. Grace is metaphorical nurturance, and it's one of the central concepts, grace and love are the central concepts in progressive Christianity. Very different idea about God, and it used to be debated openly in this country. Between 1850 and 1920, the abolitionists, who viewed God as a nurturing parent, argued against slavery. The pro-slavery position was the strict father position, in which some people are just better than other people. There's a moral order. And this is carried over into women's suffrage arguments. The same positions lined up. There were debates about whether God was nurturing or strict. Debates with tens of thousands of people. There were preachers preaching to thousands of people in cities all over the country. On just this issue, and one of the most popular essays was Christian Nurture. In the 1920s, the fundamentalists won out in the churches. The debates ended, and you got some, thinkers like Reinhold Niebuhr, who were sort of more intellectual than others later on, but popularly, the idea of God as a nurturing parent with its connection to politics, which was understood earlier, was forgotten. And that's sad. And it's still forgotten. It's not being brought together now. But fundamentalists do understand their theology and their connection to politics. And they're organized. And progressive Christians are not organized. And they need to be organized. Not an easy job. Now, what you have in the right-wing idea factory and message machine is an operation for moving these ideas. And between the idea factory, all those think tanks, and the media is a funnel. The funnel funnels ideas from the think tanks into messages. And the main person involved in that is a guy named Frank Luntz of Luntz Research. He puts out materials, a workbook, training sessions, and there are now leadership institutes that use these trainings. So the Leadership Institute in Virginia has trained 26,000 conservative leaders in 10 years. You have a new one being formed in San Diego, here, the Conservative Academy, to train the next generation of conservative leaders. What happens in this workbook is Luntz puts out several things. He takes arguments, many of them legitimate arguments that say, here are the conservative principles on this issue, here are the liberal arguments, here are the holes in the liberal arguments, here's how we argue against them, and so on. So part of it is a very legitimate, reasonable thing in giving language. He calls this the New American Language, where he goes through these arguments. Then there's a second part of it, though it's mixed in, where he lies. And the lies are interesting. They are what I'll call Orwellian language, and they go like this. There's a section on the environment that came out a couple of years ago that was leaked. All of this material has been leaked over the internet. In that section, he said, on global warming, the liberals seem to be up on us. They have science on their side. But we can win through language. Here's how. You have to use words that environmentalists like. Healthy, clean, and safe. You got a coal plant, it's healthy, clean, and safe. You got a nuclear power plant, it's healthy, clean, and safe. And George Bush, a couple of months ago, had a press conference where he talked about healthy, clean, and safe coal plants and nuclear power plants. It was also used to name the Clear Skies Initiative, which increased pollution, and the Healthy Forest Initiative, which allowed clear-cutting and destruction of forests. Now, that's the use of Orwellian language. That means the opposite of what it says. And a lot of liberals get angry when they hear this, and that's the wrong way to think. You should think like a linguist. A linguist looks at this and says, when do they use Orwellian language? They don't always do. I mean, you look at the rest of the, you know, the Luntz materials, and they're, you know, they're honest. When do they use Orwellian language? It's a simple answer. When they're weak. When they have to, and the public doesn't agree with them. When they could not come out and say, we've got a Dirty Skies Initiative. We're going to increase pollution in this bill. Right? They know they can't do that. And that should tell every progressive where to attack. And how do you attack? It's very simple. You describe it adequately. This is the Dirty Air Act. And here's why it's the Dirty Air Act. And you repeat it over and over. You know, they call it the Healthy Forest Initiatives. You call it Leave No Tree Behind. Over and over. In short, there is a way to use words to deal with these issues. But it is not the case that just coming up with the right words will do it. What is really crucial is not the surface framing of things like the Clear Air Act, the Clear Skies Act, but the deep framing that's behind it, the strict father model and the nurturing parent model. And they have literal counterparts. The strict father model has a set of fundamental frames behind it. I discovered this last year. I was invited by Nancy Pelosi to go to Washington to talk to the Democratic caucus. And she asked me to go through some of the conservative arguments for Social Security, for getting rid of Social Security. And as I went through them, I went through the liberal arguments as well. I noticed the following thing. There were a set of conservative arguments that had no facts. Now, think of something as momentous as this with no facts. Now, this is a cognitive science problem. It's an interesting phenomenon. How, in one of the most momentous issues in the history of our country, do you get an argument with no facts? The answer is very interesting. What they used was a set of what I will call fundamental frames, ideas that are used not just for Social Security, but for just about everything, general ideas. And they're ideas that come right out of the strict father model when you apply them to politics. Let me give you some examples. There's a frame that says, it's only individual initiative that has made this country great. That everybody can pull themselves up by their bootstraps, that it is the unfettered free market, unregulated, without regulation, that is the great engine of our economy, that government just gets in the way. Government is the problem. It should be, you know, gotten rid of, shrunk to the size where it can be drowned in a bathtub. It interferes with the good people trying to, you know, pursue their self-interest to become prosperous. It's un-American in that way.
George Lakoff's particular focus is the last 20 or 30 years, and his claim is that the Republicans have understood about framing and about the use of deep metaphors and have encouraged people to embrace strict father morality as opposed to nurturing parent morality. And this is particularly since the rise of advertising, which gave the business leaders a deeper understanding of how they could influence people. I'm going to look a bit further back at a phrase that I got curious about, economic literacy, and this is what Robert F. Duval, President and CEO of the U.S. National Council on Economic Education, had to say, quote, economic literacy is a vital skill, just as vital as reading literacy, unquote. So why is it called economic literacy? They're framing this to invite an obvious parallel with literacy. If you learn to read books, then you're becoming independent. You start the process where you can roll up at a library, you can teach yourself, you can find out what you need to know to be successful. If you're economically literate, then you've got the basics covered. You can be good at business, you can make money, you can succeed in the tough marketplace. If you're economically illiterate, then it's your fault if you're poor, because you need to toughen up and survive and do the hard work of learning the basics of economics. Now, one of the major purveyors of economic literacy is an organization called Junior Achievement, that's JA for short, and there's evidence of strict father morality in the form of a quote I found from their website, from Theodore Vail, one of the co-founders of JA, and in 1918 he said, quote, "The future of our country depends upon making every individual fully realize the obligations and responsibilities belonging to citizenship. Habits are formed in youth. What we need in this country now is to teach the growing generations to realize that thrift and economy, coupled with industry, are necessary now as they were in past generations." Unquote. So, he wants to teach the young generation to be thrifty, to economize, and to work hard. Not a million miles away from the agenda of John Taylor Gatto's educationalists, who are setting up schools as a way of capturing young people and getting them used to sitting in boring buildings, listening to things they don't want to do, and then going and doing them. Who was this Theodore Vail? Theodore Vail was from a very wealthy family, and he was president of AT&T, and he was infamous for centralizing power, creating closed systems, and maximizing control over every part of the phone network, an approach that came to be known as Vailism. So the organization that he started, Junior Achievement, JA, began as a collection of small after-school business clubs for students on the east coast of the US. It's grown into, quote, "the world's largest organization dedicated to educating students about work readiness, entrepreneurship, and financial literacy through experiential, hands-on programs," unquote. Its mission statement is to inspire and prepare young people to succeed in a global economy. When JA was started, it was with a lot of money from the rich industrialists, and there was no demand for this type of education. But JA now has over 300,000 volunteers. Why are they using a nurturing parent frame for economic literacy? Because it works. Because they can get 300,000 volunteers who think that they're doing the world a good turn by teaching economics to kids in kindergarten. When JA started, its first program was offered to high school students after school. But little by little, that was shifted. So in 1975, it entered the classroom for middle schoolers, and during the past 30 years it's expanded its activities and its teaching in school and out of school from grade 12 all the way down to kindergarten. What is this economic literacy? Well, here's an online economic literacy test from the Minneapolis Federal Reserve. What is the most essential characteristic of a market economy? Is it effective labor unions, good government regulation, responsible action by business leaders, or active competition in the marketplace? The correct answer is active competition in the marketplace. This is essential for the effective operation of a market economy. Competitive markets force business firms to produce the products that consumers demand at the lowest prices that will cover costs.